This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Mexico is preparing for federal and local elections this July 1st. And what more and more people who are running for office are realizing is that politics isn't just challenging and brutal, as we well know in the United States. In Mexico, it can be deadly. In the lead up to these elections, over 80 political candidates have been assassinated. Mexico is witnessing a violent turf war as drug cartels kill or intimidate any candidate who would try to stand for law and order so they can ensure politicians who will let them carry on with their dirty work. We'll hear a very informative report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller on this subject. How does the food you eat affect your mental health? A lot more than you probably think, not just right after you eat, but even over time. Your diet has major effects on how you feel, how you think, and how you behave. Later in the program today, we're going to talk about this with registered holistic nutritionist Jorg Mardian. At the end of the show, I'll conclude with a few words about doing the dirty work. But first, we will look at the extraordinary peace overtures that we are witnessing from North Korea. To learn about this, we'll hear this report from Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques.
Last year, the North Korean regime of Kim Jong-un was in full-blown weapons testing fever. First, in February, they fired a mid-range missile into the Sea of Japan. Then they conducted their first ever launch of an intercontinental ballistic missile on July 4th. Happy birthday, United States. On September 3rd, North Korea carried out its sixth and most powerful nuclear weapons test to date. And throughout the year, they conducted 18 other missile tests. And they also carried out a major cyber attack on more than 140 countries. In the United States, President Donald Trump replied to this North Korean activity with threats of war on a few occasions, saying fire and fury would rain down on the North. So tensions rose to an all-time high, and war seemed like it could be imminent. But then the situation changed. Seemingly out of the blue, Kim Jong-un said he would send some North Korean athletes to the 2018 Winter Olympics in South Korea. And on top of that, he said that they would compete with South Korean athletes under a unified banner. Kim sent his sister and some athletes and an entourage of dignitaries and others to the South, and the weapons testing came to a sudden halt. Kim ended up meeting with America's Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. He also traveled outside of North Korea for the first time since he was leader of the country. He spent a few days in Beijing visiting Chinese President Xi Jinping. And then, in late April of 2018, came the biggest news yet. Kim Jong-un crossed the border into South Korea, marking the first time any North Korean leader has entered the South for as long as the two have existed as separate nations. He and South Korean President Moon Jae-in held hands, and they planted a tree together, and they agreed to formally end the Korean War. This almost sounds like a satire story. It's a total reversal. From nonstop saber rattling and weapons tests, suddenly to jovial hugs, smiles, and hand-holding in just 5 months' time. Kim also committed to complete denuclearization. And historically, when North Korean leaders have discussed denuclearizing the peninsula, it's meant that the U.S. has to stop extending its nuclear umbrella over South Korea. So it has meant, yes, we will denuclearize if America gets its troops out of the South. But this time, Kim specified that the offer comes with no requirements to end the U.S.-South Korea alliance or to withdraw American troops from the South. And he even invited experts and journalists from South Korea and America to watch later this month as he dismantles the nuclear testing site where all six of North Korea's nuclear tests have occurred. And now Kim is scheduled to meet with U.S. President Donald Trump in the next few weeks. Ahead of that visit, he released three U.S. citizens who were being held in one of North Korea's notorious prison camps. For many onlookers, this is inexplicable and uncanny. For others, this is all just the result of President Trump's solid and very successful foreign policy. But if we look at the recent history of North Korea, we see that what may seem to be Kim Jong-un's desperation, or sudden reversal, or possibly even irrationality, is actually the continuation of a well-established and well-calculated survival strategy. And North Korea's track record over the last 30 years shows that it is too early to declare peace on the Korean Peninsula, or to award President Trump the Nobel Peace Prize, which he has officially been nominated for as a result of what's been happening on the peninsula. And the reason why it's too early to declare peace is because North Korea has a long history of breaking its promises. In 1985, for example, North Korea signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and then they continued to secretly develop their nuclear weapons program. In 1992, the North signed a joint denuclearization declaration with South Korea, and it also signed a safeguards deal with the International Atomic Energy Association. And then just 1 year later, Pyongyang refused to let the inspectors view parts of its nuclear holdings, and the North threatened to withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It happened again in 1994 when the North signed the famous Agreed Framework, and it promised to dismantle its nuclear program. And then within just a short time, Pyongyang was found to have been resuming its development of uranium enrichment capacity. It happened once again in the year 2000. That time, there was even a Nobel Prize awarded to the president of South Korea. And then just 2 years later, the North admitted that it had been advancing its uranium enrichment capacity once again. And they told inspectors to leave the country. A couple of years later, North Korea conducted its first nuclear weapons test. It happened once again in 2007. And in every case, North Korea's promises were welcomed by the world with hope and optimism, and they were often rewarded with foreign aid and by relaxing sanctions. And in every case, the North broke the promises. And today it's a nuclear-armed nation. So maybe this time around is different. Maybe Kim has determined that life would be better for him and his comrades without all the sanctions and embargoes. Maybe after years of obstinacy, he's truly ready to compromise. Maybe President Trump's maximum pressure campaign worked. Perhaps because he was able to bring China on side. Maybe the combination of Trump's unpredictability and his bellicosity frightened the North into finally yielding. There are many maybes in play, but North Korea's track record over the last 30 years shows that it is still too early to be celebrating. Kim Jong-un's number one goal is to stay in power. So we may wonder why he seems to risk staying in power by antagonizing the most powerful nation on the planet, the United States. But the country that Kim inherited is impoverished and primitive, and if he does nothing, it'll wither and collapse. But he also doesn't want to make economic reforms. Reforms translate into better living conditions for everyone. But Kim doesn't want this because if his people were stronger and better informed, he would be threatened by revolution or by a coup. So Kim needs resources, but he can't afford economic reform. So the solution is foreign aid. And to get assistance from the United States, he has to instill fear in America. And to instill this fear in a country that's so much more powerful than his, he has to have nuclear weapons. His small arsenal of deliverable nuclear weapons shelters Kim from invasion from outside powers and from internal uprisings. And it legitimizes him. So that makes nuclear weapons a perfect negotiation tool. The idea of denuclearizing North Korea is so appealing and enticing that the United States and other powers seem willing to do almost anything for even a slim chance of seeing it happen. They're even willing to forget 30 years of broken promises and failed foreign policy. North Korea creates a crisis. They drive tensions and worry as high as possible. Then when it seems like war is inevitable, they offer to negotiate. With great relief, the global powers accept. And this time, because he has a nuclear deterrent in place, it is different. As of November 28th of last year, just after they tested the Hwasong-15 missile, they have the ability for the first time to strike the United States mainland with nuclear weapons. And then it was just 2 months later that Kim said North Korea was going to the Olympics, which began the whole thaw. So there's no need for more missile testing now. Now they're trying to cash out and get all they can from freezing the tests, while maintaining, even if it means in secret, the capacity to strike America. And it's also significant that the Trump administration strongly desires being able to say that their foreign policy worked. Trump really wants a victory to show to his opponents and his supporters alike, and this strong desire actually gives Kim even more negotiating leverage. So the Trump-Kim talks may fail, or they may succeed with a lot of boisterous celebrations, but it's likely, even with an apparent success, that Kim will thrill the world with lofty offers of concessions, but it won't end up materializing into anything concrete. The North may stop nuclear development, but that would only be because they no longer need it. And that will be in exchange for some U.S. military concessions that also benefit Russia and China, who want nothing more than for America to get out of Asia. And if we view the Korean Peninsula through the lens of Bible prophecy, then we should expect the U.S. presence in South Korea to come to an end sometime soon. The most detailed passage of prophecy showing this is Ezekiel 38, which talks about an Asian military bloc that will form in the end time. Verse 2 shows that Russia will be the lead nation in this alliance, and that China will be the second most powerful nation in the bloc. And then in verses 5 and 6, it lists several specific smaller Asian peoples called by their ancient names that will also be a part of this block. And one of the ancient names listed there is Gomer, which is the primary ancestor of the modern Koreans. We don't know all the details of how this Asian confederacy will come together, but the strong implication of this passage is that in the near future, both Koreas, whether they're united or not, will be rallied behind Russia and China.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. There's a lot of great points to chew on there. You talked about these past instances where North Korea lied about denuclearizing. It seems people have quite short memories. And in some ways, Kim Jong-un and the others who are involved in this are kind of counting on that fact.
That's exactly right. His strategy is brilliant because he knows how to manufacture a crisis. He knows how to create fear and just ramp up all the worry and all the tensions. And then once it gets to what appears to be a breaking point, the United States and other powers are so desperate to alleviate all of that concern that they'll, you know, it seems like they just are willing to forget about all of the other times, just this pattern of lying, getting concessions, and then doing it all again, the cycle that we've seen.
So you're almost viewing what happened last year as part of the strategy, that maybe he had this in mind even when he was ramping up the tension last year.
It does seem like what we've seen over the last 30 years is that the leader of North Korea is either in antagonizing mode, you know, saber rattling, rushing ahead at full speed to develop their missiles and their nuclear weapons, or in charm mode, you know, I'm a good guy. I just need a little bit of cash assistance and I'll change everything. I'm ready to turn it around. I'm really sorry. So, you know, it's either in one of those two modes. That's basically been the cycle.
Yeah. So this cycle having played out several times, and you made some very good points about just how crucial the possession of nuclear weapons are to his survival as a regime, as the leader of North Korea. But there are, it seems, a few signs that maybe this is something different than what we've seen in the past. I just wonder what your thoughts are. If this actually works, what would be the results of that? You alluded to that at the end of your piece there, that this could actually help to bring that unification about, of the unification of Asia that we expect based on Bible prophecy.
Yes, that's right. I feel like most likely, if history is an indicator, then even if we see him dismantle his weapons facilities, that there would be others kept in secret. But you're exactly right that it is different this time. It really does seem like things are, there are a few factors present that were not there before. And it could well be that China has applied pressure that in previous iterations of this pattern, they've not applied. And China has basically been the lifeline for North Korea for, you know, 50, 60 years. And so if Beijing said, we're no longer supporting this pattern, from now on, we want you to essentially be a province of China, and we want you to be well-behaved. So you're either going to be taken out as leader of North Korea, or you're going to make a show of dismantling everything, possibly even actually dismantle everything. From now on, you're a Chinese province, and those are your choices. Be, you know, assassinated, or from now on, you're secretly kind of a Chinese state. It would not surprise me at all if during that meeting that we saw earlier this year and in other communications that President Xi Jinping in China presented Kim Jong-un with some options like that.
Well, it certainly is interesting to look at it from the standpoint of these pragmatic considerations that you're discussing. This, we're not just talking about a change of heart on Kim Jong-un's part. This isn't, you know, he's finally revealing just what a nice guy he is. There would be real cause for this. China would be the primary instigator behind what is happening here. And it seems if that is what's happening, that they are at least comfortable enough with the idea of Donald Trump getting some credit or that type of thing. But this is certainly in China's best interests. And maybe you could just talk a little bit about how this Asian unification is going to come about, just the way that we're looking at this from what the Bible says explicitly.
Sure, yes. Well, the passage that I mentioned there in Ezekiel 38, it does talk about, you know, the prince of Russia leading this massive block, and it talks about Magog, the area that includes modern day China, being right there in the block, and it lists Gomer, which as I mentioned is the ancient name for the primary peoples of modern North and South Korea, as being a part of it. So it seems that whether it's from some outcome from this present, you know, round of appeasement that we're seeing from North Korea, or from some other Chinese pressure, it really seems like China will be the player that that will bring North Korea into the Russo-Chinese orbit. You know, just the overwhelming majority of North Korea's trade over the last several decades has been with China. Without China, they would have collapsed long ago. Mm-hmm. And so it's very difficult to say how China will apply that pressure or how they possibly have already applied it. But the fact that China has been North Korea's lifeline shows that they have leverage to, you know, when they've had enough of Kim Jong-un behaving in a way that is no longer beneficial to China, they could easily apply pressure to bring them into that block that Ezekiel foretold. We have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy, which really digs into the details of that prophecy in Ezekiel 38 and 39. And it goes into numerous other Bible passages about the nations of Asia in the end time. So I would just encourage any listeners who want to know more about what's ahead for the Korean Peninsula and for the world, and also about just how much hope is ultimately tied to these tensions and these developments, I would encourage them to go to thetrumpet.com and order a free copy of Russia and China in Prophecy.
Well, we've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about North Korea and these overtures for peace that we're seeing today. He has an article on thetrumpet.com that you can check out in addition to Russia and China in Prophecy, that booklet that he mentioned. But this article that he's written is called Peace and Prosperity on the Korean Peninsula. Look for that at thetrumpet.com. And thank you very much for your report, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Politics can be a challenging, difficult business, but right now in many parts of Mexico, it is also deadly dangerous, as we will now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
Mexico is suffering its bloodiest election campaign in history. Over 80 political candidates have already been assassinated in the lead-up to Mexico's federal and local elections, which are scheduled for July 1st. According to a recent report, 90% of this violence has occurred against politicians running for state and municipal offices. Among the casualties is 25-year-old Maribel Barajas Cortez, a Green Party candidate whose body was discovered with multiple stab wounds near her car. Then there is Juan Carlos Andrade Magana, who was running for re-election as mayor of his small town until he was found dead in his Toyota with multiple gunshot wounds. With approximately 3,400 political offices open this election season, drug cartels are undoubtedly behind this wave of violence. If drug traffickers can intimidate or control police and politicians, they can continue their deadly business. A professor of public administration in Tijuana explained to Reuters that cartel leaders are looking to install puppet lawmakers and take out their contenders, while intimidating reformers who may want to curb their flow of drug traffic. This task is made easier when you have an army at your disposal. The United States Defense Department estimates that over 100,000 drug traffickers work directly for Mexican cartels. That's almost as many as the 130,000 soldiers who work for Mexico's military, and the drug cartel ranks continue to swell. This violence is turning Mexico into a failed state, and it is not limited to the nation south of the Rio Grande. American law enforcement estimate that Mexican cartels have infiltrated more than 3,000 U.S. cities. The 2017 National Drug Threat Assessment, released by the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, shows the grip of drug cartels have on several Texan cities is growing stronger. They are reportedly pumping cocaine, heroin, methamphetamines, and marijuana into the state from El Paso to Galveston. And while many U.S. Border Control agents are faithfully waging war against these evils, a growing number are actually facilitating them. In 2016, the New York Times reported that between 2006 and 2016, nearly 200 employees of the Department of Homeland Security took $15 million in bribes. The agents are bought, a cartel boss in the armed wing of the Juarez cartel told Mexican newspaper El Universal in 2016. The large load passes by the checkpoint, passed by immigration. They are all arranged. A car greets them, and it is given an envelope with a lot of money. Already they are told what color and what brand of car is coming with the load, and they let it pass. President Donald Trump has pledged to break the back of the cartels by building a wall on the Mexican border. This is an admirable pledge, but how effective is a wall if the custodians covertly remove its bricks? Mexican drug cartels target Border Control agents because of America's insatiable appetite for their product. This demand perpetuates the corruption of our officials and even the defection of our soldiers. Cartels have been caught recruiting corrupt U.S. soldiers to act as hitmen in the U.S., paying them to assassinate federal informants and crime rivals. So how long until America's drug habit causes the type of political assassinations already plaguing Mexico to spread north as well? An estimated 55% of all Mexican homicides and 7% of all U.S. homicides are related to drug trafficking. And the problem is getting worse. Conservatives say this problem can be fixed with a border wall, while progressives say that legalizing marijuana and decriminalizing hard drugs like heroin and methamphetamines will help turn cartel agents into law-abiding citizens. But the truth of the matter is that politicians are being shot and border control agents are being bribed because a spiritual sickness has taken root throughout North America. The Bible calls this sickness pharmakonia, and it's listed as one of the works of the flesh in Galatians 5. The King James translations renders this word as witchcraft, but a more exact rendering is the use or the administration of drugs. Even during the time period when the New Testament was being written, the hypnotic qualities of the poppy plant were well known, and the ancient Greeks used opium in their pagan religious ceremonies. Things have only become worse in the past 2,000 years. Today, approximately 25 million U.S. citizens and 4 million Mexican citizens use opium, heroin, and other drugs in a vain attempt to fill a spiritual void in their lives with drug-induced moments of fleeting euphoria. But the fruits of drug addiction only make this spiritual void worse. In the Old Testament, the prophet Hosea foretold that the modern-day descendants of ancient Israel would suffer serious problems if they rebelled against God's law. In the first few verses of Hosea 4, the prophet writes, "Hear the word of the Lord, you children of Israel, for the Lord has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land. There is no truth, nor mercy, nor knowledge of God in the land. By swearing and lying and killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break out, and blood touches blood. Therefore shall the land mourn, and everyone dwell therein shall languish, with the beast of the field and the fowls of the heaven, yea, and the fishes of the sea shall also be taken away." Now this passage describes cause and effect. Because there's no truth, nor mercy, nor knowledge of God in the land, people swear and lie and kill and steal and commit adultery. The resulting immorality breaks families apart. It leads millions of youth to hopelessness. These youth then join gangs and take drugs, and the end result is that blood touches blood. The violence becomes so bad that there's hardly a reprieve between stabbings, shootings, and political assassinations. And this isn't a problem that can be solved by the White House. It's a problem that must be solved by the 168 million houses spread out across Mexico, the United States, and Canada. If there isn't repentance and change on a nationwide scale, the ripple effects of transgressing God's law will continue to spread until the entire North American continent experiences a tsunami of violence, even worse than the horrific crime wave that has already inundated Mexico.
Thank you for that, Andrew. That is a horrifying picture. Starting with the violence that you're describing down in Mexico, going into public office, this is quite a dangerous job. The individuals who are doing this recognize that just the very act of entering public office is somewhat of a challenge to the cartels, isn't it? And the cartels, I mean, we're really talking about a turf war here. The cartels aren't going to just sit down and allow them to do that without seriously intimidating.
Right. And especially when you look at the geography of Mexico along the west coast and the north border with the United States, it's further away from Mexico City where the central government is. And so the further away you get from there, the stronger the cartels get. Hmm. So you can look at Mexico as that kind of that central plateau around Mexico City is more or less a stable nation state with a bad crime problem. But as you get to those north provinces and those west provinces, it's really not an exaggeration to say it's a failed state already, mm-hmm. where local politicians know that the drug cartels are stronger than the federal government, and anyone who stands against them could just have their head cut off in the middle of the night or be shot in a drive-by shooting. And their drug cartels, they're really trying to use that leverage to tip this election. You're having this big election come up July 1st, and it's actually a presidential election for Mexico, but there's also a lot of local, as I mentioned, 3,400 local positions that are open. And so they're really trying to mainly tip these local elections, even though the federal election amnesty is being amnesty against cartel agents is being a big talking point being bandied about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you did an excellent job of pointing to the real cause. And we've talked quite a bit over the years as we've watched this horrific situation play out in Mexico. The fact that it is largely American drug demand that is empowering these cartels. You look at that from the standpoint of where they're getting all of their resources to be able to mount essentially a second army in Mexico. You mentioned 100,000 foot soldiers in the cartel's army versus 130,000 in the actual standing army of the Mexican armed forces. So that's obviously a huge consideration. But then the other thing that you mentioned is just these border agents on the United States who've allowed themselves to succumb to corruption as they're being bought off by these cartels.
Right. I mean, that is kind of some of the two main weapons of these cartels is intimidation and bribery. And Mexico definitely has a problem with both. In America, we mentioned about them like hiring off some corrupt military officials to take out informants and to take out rival crime bosses within the borders of the United States. They haven't actually targeted politicians as much in the United States just because they've had good success so far bribing people. But like I said, they did that one study and found that that they can tell like one out of every 100 Border Patrol agents has been caught taking bribes to let drug shipments through. Mm-hmm. And they just make that point is that, I mean, especially the Trump movements put a huge emphasis on a border wall to stop the flow of illegal immigrants and drug traffics into the nation. And maybe that would help.
It would help.
But it's not
But it's not really addressing the cause, is it?
Right. It doesn't address the cause, and it isn't a foolproof solution because, like I said, a lot of these, I mean, that is one way drug cartels get their drugs into the United States is to use they call them mules. They're not really mules. They're illegal immigrants. And to just say that, well, we'll let you pass through our territory on your way to the U.S. if you take this drug shipment with you. But another big way, as they mentioned, is that they just have cars actually come in down the street and then bribe the border agent and wave it through. Mm-hmm. And so obviously no one's talking about a border wall that's going to shut down the roads that go into Mexico.
And well, I think this is a phenomenal illustration of the curses that result from sin, because you can see how it is sin involved in this, that you're talking about becoming literally enslaved to drug use to where you're empowering, you're sending money to individuals who are lawbreakers, that are living lives that are enmeshed in criminality at every level. And so there's bad fruits, there's bad ripple effects all the way up and down the chain, and you can see lives being lost. You see these politicians that are unable to get control over their own jurisdiction because the cartels have preeminence there. And you can see, I think you brought it out very well in that report, this is only going to lead to worse. As long as we continue to allow these to happen without dealing with the causes, the effects are only going to get worse. And we can point to specific prophecies that give us a sense of the scale.
Right, because it was actually a joke kind of going around in Mexico, and it's kind of a dark joke. But they said that if President Trump ever gets his wall built, well, the 25 million Americans addicted to drug will be frothing at the mouth and they'll tear it down brick by brick. Just kind of pointing to the fact that, like I said, as long as there's a huge, like, 25 million people in the United States that want these illegal drugs, I mean, they'll find a way to get the supply. And that's something that kind of makes the Trumpet unique from most other news agencies you'd hear talk about this topic, is that we dig down beneath the border wall, drug legalization, this much money into this security debate, and figures, like I said, no, as long as there's broken families, people growing up without any religion or hope or purpose in their life, and they're using heroin or cocaine to try to fill that void, there is going to be that need, and these problems are going to get worse.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about some of the nightmarish violence that the drug cartels are perpetrating down south of the border in Mexico. You can actually go online to thetrumpet.com and read the article that he's written about this subject. The title is Drug Cartels Murder Politicians, and it also has links to some of the prophetic material that we're talking about, just showing how severe these problems are going to get when we fail to deal with the source of the problem. Well, Andrew, excellent, chilling report. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Food can make or break your mood. This is apparent not only right after you eat, but also over time. Your diet has consequences, and it actually correlates with how you feel and how you act. Our brain needs a constant supply of fuel, and the foods that we eat, what's in that fuel, make all the difference. What you eat directly affects even the structure and function of your brain. To talk about this, we have from his office in British Columbia, registered holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian. Hello, Jörg.
Hello there.
This is an interesting topic we have here. Tell us about the connection between what we eat and our mental health.
Sure. And it is an interesting topic. I think a lot of people just don't put the two together, particularly with so much depression that we're seeing today. Depression actually accounts globally for the highest burden of disability, mental disability. And a lot of that is even prior to 14 years of age. And these rates are just surging. Now, alongside this escalation in mental health, we're seeing an increase in the consumption of highly processed foods. And then the intake of nutrient and fiber-dense foods is diminishing. So, unfortunately, many understand the connection between nutritional deficiencies and physical illness, but they're not aware of the connection between nutrition and mood regulation.
Okay, so tell us where this process starts, if you're what you eat, how that would actually impact the body.
Well, the process starts like a lot of things in the body, in what I call the engine of the body, the gut. We have what's called a bacterial ecosystem, and that consists of just trillions of bacteria, and most of them are very beneficial to us. They're not harmful. Now, not only do the gut bacteria not sicken us, but they're vital to health in many ways. And so some of these roles of gut bacteria are actually, they regulate hormones of the body, which we've all heard of, feel-good hormones. They help extract nutrients and energy from our food. They digest fiber, which is highly important. They even manage body weight and help regulate our appetite, our moods, our motivation, as well as our cognitive health. But most important, having a good, healthy bacterial balance protects or helps to modulate the immune system, which protects against pathogens going into the body and microbes that enter the body. So it really has a vast set of responsibilities for us.
Okay, well, you talk quite a bit about the importance of gut health, but we haven't really talked much about how it affects your mental health. How does gut health affect mental health?
Yeah, and that's an interesting connection, and science has really studied that for a long time, but we're just catching up to the fact now that mainstream medicine is jumping on this. And, you know, we understand that the brain has billions of neurons, and these have a close working relationship with the bacteria in your gut, with those trillions of bacteria. And these bacteria are really instrumental in how the brain develops. So how we behave, how we handle stress, how we handle anxiety. And we also know that during times of stress, the bacteria profile actually changes in our gut. And it shifts in how it interacts with each other. And I mean, this is just fascinating. So that gut-brain relationship basically comes down to how the immune system alters the nervous system. And a lot of that has to do with the food that we eat. I mean, healthy food provides what we call the building blocks for these neurotransmitters like serotonin, which helps us to relax, and dopamine, which helps us to feel focused. So we get a lot of what we call ultra-processed fast foods and baked foods, and they don't have the nutrients that we really need to contribute to providing the right balance for these neurotransmitters. And what that leads to is a lot of undesirable mood swings, depression, even greater aggression. So, I mean, that's not the only cause, of course. There's a lot of other things that can change gut bacteria. GMOs, genetically modified organisms, chemicals, additives in foods, antibiotics. They're also factors. But the thing is, there is a pathway. It's what we call the second brain. The gut is actually what we call the second brain. And there's a close relationship between these neurons, between the brain and the gut. And, you know, if you disrupt one, like the gut bacteria, you're going to disrupt the other because we're one organism. It all interplays with each other, right? So we have to look at it and say, how are we actually feeding that ecosystem of bacteria to further feed our mental health?
It's just amazing how many different aspects of life get back to what you're putting into your mouth. And here you're talking about your moods, your ability to handle stresses in life, tracing back to the same thing. So you've alluded to it in a couple of ways, but just talk about, say, the unhealthy foods and those things that would contribute to poor mental health, and then we can get into maybe some of the better alternatives and things that would actually promote your mental health.
Right. Well, we all know about junk foods, you know, and what we call processed foods, the canned and boxed foods, and most of those don't contribute to a healthy gut bacteria. But there's some others that we might not think of. One of the ones that, you know, I've looked at for a long time is wheat. So we always talk about white flour being bad. But now there's science emerging that shows that whole wheat flour, most commercial whole wheat flour, is also being challenged by experts. The laws and regulations around labeling around this whole wheat is extremely lax. Now, I'm not sure if you know, but your 100% whole grain label actually means that you only have about 51% of the original grain in the United States being incorporated into that food.
I was not aware of that. That's remarkable.
It is. It's stunning, actually. And the other 49% can be processed grains. In Canada, it's basically the same thing. We allow 5% of the wheat kernel to be removed from the whole wheat flour, which really removes 70% of the nutrient-rich germ. And when you're ingesting that, really that food acts the same. That whole wheat acts the same with your glycemic index as white flour. And that's a stunning admission from science. So when we're looking at these foods and we've been indoctrinated, it's not the same as in the days of old when you had the whole kernel and you ground it. I mean, that's a very alkaline way to eat, and it's a very good way to feed the bacteria. But the stuff that's commercial today, the way that they process it, we're only getting half of the nutrients that we think we are, or less. And that creates to more of an acidic environment. It creates to a breakdown in that bacterial balance. And when the bacteria, when you start getting candida and all kinds of other pathogenic conditions, the immune system, which normally talks with the bacteria, they don't have that interplay of communication, and the immune system can actually attack gut bacteria. And then we get, getting the gut becoming porous and leaking all kinds of proteins and other undesirable things into the bloodstream. And then we get autoimmune diseases and so on and so on. It's just a tidal wave of health conditions that stem from that. And I think we talked previously about how many conditions come from, a bad gut bacteria. And science is now saying we can have diabetes, we can have arthritis, even cancer may stem from that. But importantly, as we're talking about today, mental health conditions, which are rampant, are one of the things that we're looking at with a good bacterial balance.
That's amazing. So including wheat in those, what is labeled whole wheat in those foods that we need to watch for or limit our intake of in order to help our mental health, what would be foods that we would go after in order to give ourselves better mental health?
Well, we can look at more of a traditional diet. I mean, we have so much sugar in foods today. We have so much processing. We have so many additives. We need to look at what a traditional Mediterranean diet looks like, or say the traditional Japanese diet, which were famous for longevity. And simply, quite simply, they include more vegetables, more fruits, unprocessed grains, seafood, and a good amount of fermented foods. And those fermented foods contain good bacteria. Mm-hmm. And, there's a link between probiotic foods such as pickles and sauerkraut and kefir and a lowering of anxiety.
Wow.
Studies show us that. And as well, if you want to look at what are healthy whole grains, you can look at actual whole grain quinoa, not the flour, millet, barley, oats, steel-cut oats or buckwheat. Those are really, really good grains because they still include most of the nutrients, the bran and the high amounts of fiber and natural antioxidants that our body really needs to work properly. And fermented or sprouted whole grains are even more beneficial because they're metabolized so slowly in the body, and they ensure that the correct amount of glucose enters the blood and boosts the brain power or concentration. And then that gives us a calmer feeling.
Okay, what about what we drink? How might that help or hurt us?
Right. So liquids are a powerful part of that process as well, because caffeine, for example, is a stimulant, and it promotes alertness and vigilance and reaction time. And really, caffeine has a lot of benefits to the body. But in excess, it may increase anxiety or depression in certain individuals. Let's look at lack of water. If you don't drink enough water, you can have difficulty concentrating or thinking clearly, and you may get headaches or confusion or tiredness. And if you, studies show if you increase a low water intake, it improves mood. But I think that the biggest killer in the liquid category is sugary drinks, because there's a study from the California Center for Public Health Advocacy that the average American drinks approximately, and get this, 700 sodas per year.
Ay, ay, ay.
And that's the equivalent of 39 pounds of mood-busting sugar. 39 pounds.
That's crazy. You get rid of that one thing and you're doing a whole lot to clean up your diet and make your mood better.
Absolutely. That sugar is one of the primary ways that we can kill bacterial balance in the colon. So if you get rid of those 700 sodas, you're going to go a long ways towards improving your health.
Yeah. Well, that's terrific. Actionable intelligence from Jörg Mardian, as usual. We've been talking with registered holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian about the link between food and mood and mental health. He's working on an article that will appear on thetrumpet.com on this subject. You can watch for that online. Thanks, as always, Jörg.
Good to be here.
It's time for today's last word.
It was a gloriously beautiful day. My son and I were enjoying the outdoors, weeding our landscaping beds together. A neighborhood kid stopped by and was watching us. "Would you like to help?" I asked. "No, I don't want to get my nice clothes dirty." He wasn't exactly dressed in formal wear. It looked like a perfectly good weeding outfit to me. I suspected there was another reason for his refusal. He just wasn't that stoked about weeding. What is your attitude toward work? Do you hate getting your hands dirty? If so, I'm telling you, you're missing out. God is a hard worker. Jesus said, "My Father works hitherto, and I work." A lot of people hate work, but God loves it. Some people won't do something unless they enjoy it or they happen to feel like doing it. A lot of people earn a living without ever getting dirty. There are a lot of jobs, however, that might not be immediately enjoyable, but that have to be done. Many jobs require handling things that are grimy or smelly, getting down on hands and knees, doing hard or unpleasant things, using your muscles, getting sweaty, putting your hands in the dirt. Proverbs 14 and verse 4 says something about this. It reads, "Where no oxen are, the crib is clean, but much increase is by the strength of the ox." And what does that mean? For thousands of years in human history, oxen were the tractors of the farm. They were also sources of meat, leather, fertilizer, and a lot of other necessities and luxuries in life. They were worth the equivalent of thousands of dollars because they're extremely strong, and a farmer can produce a lot of things by working with them. A man with a lot of oxen is wealthy and productive. Now, oxen are also dirty. They smell, they produce urine and dung. You probably don't deal with those things yourself, but guess what? In more ways than you realize, you benefit from the labors of people who are willing to get dirty in working with oxen. A stall with no oxen will be clean, but what purpose does an empty stall serve? If you want to have much increase, you have to be ready to do some dirty jobs. There's a lot to be gained from embracing hard work, even enjoying it. Honest work is a tremendous pleasure. It teaches you to be useful. It teaches you to be patient and stick with a thing, to persevere through difficulty. It teaches the right kind of independence and self-sufficiency. Work makes you happy. When you accomplish something, you feel good. When you waste time, you're unfulfilled and unhappy. But when you finish an involved project and when you accumulate skill and achievement over time, you can take great satisfaction from that. Work also teaches you to embrace a challenge. We really never ought to shy away from a job because it requires us to get dirty. After all, God made us out of dirt, and He made us so that we have to work the soil for our food and for our livelihoods. If you shrink from a challenge that God gives you, you'll fail to mature. If you never pick up a heavy weight, your muscles will get weaker. If you avoid hard mental work, your mind will wither. God uses challenges to spur our growth and prepare us for even greater challenges. God wants to teach us that hard work brings rewards, that good fruit is a product of quality effort, that you reap what you sow. His law is, written in 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 10, that if any would not work, neither should he eat. You may keep a clean crib, but you're not going to have much increase. So throw yourself into the dirty job. Learn to enjoy hard work, and you're sure to reap good results throughout your life. Joel Hilliker. That will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Mark Hopkins. Our prayer and God's mercy are like two buckets in a well. While one ascends, the other descends. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.